Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de la región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Inglés. Nivel C1. Convocatoria ordinaria 2023. Comprensión de textos orales.
Task 1. Please read the instructions and the task.
Example.
Deserved representation of my favourite writer of all time, Mr. William Shakespeare, with Hamlet. Yes, Hamlet is the best thing Shakespeare ever put together. It's not necessarily my personal favourite, although I do utterly adore it. I think it is a work of staggering genius. You can keep Hamlet on your bedside for...
Extract number one.
Shakespeare, because it is Leo Tolstoy and War and Peace, an astonishing literary accomplishment, and again something that I'm working on some content for at the current moment. I love the character arcs in this sweeping novel. Yes, Tolstoy didn't call it a novel, he said it wasn't a novel. His first novel was Anna Karenina, but whatever it is, whatever we want to call it, we must experience it. Over the long term.
Extract number two.
Time, and that is Herman Melville's Moby Dick, this grand prose poem that is ostensibly about a whale hunt, but not really. It's about so much more. Again, we have a very long lecture series dedicated to deep reading this book at the Hardcore Literature Book Club. Where to even begin with this novel? It is a journey. The prose is gorgeous. It's a lot.
Extract number 3.
Next up, we have The Great Gatsby at spot number 5 by F. Scott Fitzgerald. A great book. I think this is reflective of just how many lists this has appeared on and how far up those lists it has appeared on. Does it deserve to be in the top 50? Most likely. It is a great book. It definitely would deserve to be in the top 100. I'm due a reread, and I cannot help but think of one of my friends from university who was absolutely...
Extract number 4.
Fourth spot, 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, along with Thomas Mann, those are the two biggies that I am most overtly and deliberately waiting to return to. I read 100 Years of Solitude many years ago and loved it. I also tried to read it in Spanish when I was trying to teach myself Spanish. I didn't persevere with learning Spanish for too long. And I was utterly mesmerized by this work. And I have really fond...
Extract number 5.
At third spot, we have Don Quixote by Cervantes. Twinned with Moby Dick for one of my personal favourite novels of all time, we go on these wonderful little adventures with our knight-errant and his squire, Sancho Panza. But it's not the adventures that we find ourselves reading on for. We read Don Quixote for the conversations between these two friends. I think these two have the best friendship in all of literature, and what an incredible period of literary history. We have Michel de Montaigne penning the personal essay in France, we have the Englishman putting on Hamlet, and then we have Don Quixote again. If you haven't read Don Quixote, you need to put it quite far up on...
Extract number 6.
Very interesting. We have Ulysses by James Joyce. Yeah, Ulysses. Ulysses is a very difficult work. It's very dense, it's very layered, and it requires rereading, it requires patience, it requires commentaries, it requires a lot of perseverance. When I first came to Ulysses, I was quite young, and I found myself intoxicated by the language. As I grew older, I became a little bit dismissive of it, and, as many people do, thought that Joyce may be flipping off his reading public. He said famously of Finnegan's Wake, he wanted readers to spend 17 years reading it. And you can do the same with Ulysses.
Extract number 7.
Number 1. At top spot, we have Marcel Proust's In Search of Lost Time. Fabulous. Well, how can anyone be unhappy? I love to read Proust really slowly. I like to bake rereading in, and I use Proust as an opportunity to journal. I like to read and reread and relish and read aloud and then return, go back to the beginning and break pages apart, follow different rabbit holes. And Proust, perhaps more than any other writer, really does offer us this really nice...
Example.
Deserved representation of my favourite writer of all time, Mr. William Shakespeare, with Hamlet. Yes, Hamlet is the best thing Shakespeare ever put together. It's not necessarily my personal favourite, although I do utterly adore it. I think it is a work of staggering genius. You can keep Hamlet on your bedside for...
Extract number one.
Shakespeare, because it is Leo Tolstoy and War and Peace, an astonishing literary accomplishment, and again something that I'm working on some content for at the current moment. I love the character arcs in this sweeping novel. Yes, Tolstoy didn't call it a novel, he said it wasn't a novel. His first novel was Anna Karenina. But whatever it is, whatever we want to call it, we must experience it. Over the long term.
Extract number two.
Time, and that is Herman Melville's Moby Dick, this grand prose poem that is ostensibly about a whale hunt, but not really. It's about so much more. Again, we have a very long lecture series dedicated to deep reading this book at the Hardcore Literature Book Club. Where to even begin with this novel? It is a journey. The prose is gorgeous. It's a lot.
Extract number three.
Next up, we have The Great Gatsby at spot number five by F. Scott Fitzgerald. A great book. I think this is reflective of just how many lists this has appeared on and how far up those lists it has appeared on. Does it deserve to be in the top 50? Most likely. It is a great book. It definitely would deserve to be in the top 100. I'm due a reread, and I cannot help but think of one of my friends from university who was absolutely...
Extract number four.
Fourth spot, 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, along with Thomas Mann, those are the two biggies that I am most overtly and deliberately waiting to return to. I read 100 Years of Solitude many years ago and loved it. I also tried to read it in Spanish when I was trying to teach myself Spanish. I didn't persevere with learning Spanish for too long, and I was utterly mesmerized by this work, and I have really fond...
Extract number five.
At third spot, we have Don Quixote by Cervantes. Twinned with Moby Dick for one of my personal favourite novels of all time, we go on these wonderful little adventures with our knight-errant and his squire, Sancho Panza. But it's not the adventures that we find ourselves reading on for. We read Don Quixote for the conversations between these two friends. I think these two have the best friendship in all of literature, and what an incredible period of literary history. We have Michel de Montaigne penning the personal essay in France, we have the Englishman putting on Hamlet, and then we have Don Quixote again. If you haven't read Don Quixote, you need to put it quite far up on...
Extract number six.
Very interesting. We have Ulysses by James Joyce. Yeah, Ulysses. Ulysses is a very difficult work. It's very dense, it's very layered, and it requires rereading, it requires patience, it requires commentaries, it requires a lot of perseverance. When I first came to Ulysses, I was quite young, and I found myself intoxicated by the language. As I grew older, I became a little bit dismissive of it, and, as many people do, thought that Joyce may be flipping off his reading public. He said famously of Finnegan's Wake, he wanted readers to spend 17 years reading it. And you can do the same with Ulysses.
Extract number seven.
Number one. At top spot, we have Marcel Proust's In Search of Lost Time. Fabulous. Well, how can anyone be unhappy? I love to read Proust really slowly. I like to bake rereading in, and I use Proust as an opportunity to journal. I like to read and reread and relish and read aloud and then return, go back to the beginning and break pages apart, follow different rabbit holes. And Proust, perhaps more than any other writer, really does offer us this really nice...
Task 2. Please read the instructions and the task.
How can you tell if there are birds on an island without visiting that island? Conservationists in Hawaii found two high-tech ways to answer that question. First, they are using special equipment called acoustic recording units, which record sounds remotely. Second, the conservationists are using drones that have cameras. These cameras don't take normal pictures. The cameras scan the ground with sensors that record the temperatures of objects. The cameras produce pictures based on the different temperatures of the objects. This process is called thermal imaging. You might wonder why these scientists are going to so much trouble. They're doing this because they are looking for endangered birds. The birds are the Newell's shearwater and the Hawaiian petrel. They are only found in Hawaii, and there are only a few left. These birds face many threats, including flying into power lines at night. Young shearwaters and petrels heading to the sea for the first time can become confused by bright lights at night and run into buildings and other structures. They are also threatened by non-native predators, including feral cats. Newell's shearwaters are black and white birds that can grow more than 12 inches long. Their wingspan can be up to 3 feet wide. The Hawaiian petrel is dark gray and white and can grow to 16 inches long. They also have a wingspan of 3 feet and are popular seabirds in Hawaii. They make a lot of different sounds. One of their calls sounds like ooh-ah-ooh, and people enjoy hearing it. Seabirds such as the Newell's shearwater and Hawaiian petrel are important to their ecosystems. Their poop contains high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus, which are important nutrients for plants. Conservationists thought Newell's shearwaters and Hawaiian petrels lived mainly on the island of Kauai, and that none of them lived on the island of Oahu. Then a few birds were spotted on Oahu. The conservationists wondered if these birds were looking for mates and mating. They didn't want to disturb the birds, so they placed the acoustic recording units in remote mountain locations where birds had been seen. They recorded the birds' sounds to see if they could hear mating calls. Then scientists started using drones to see if they could find the nesting locations for these rare seabirds on Oahu. Although they are still looking at all the information they have collected, it does look like the seabirds may be nesting on Oahu. That is good news for these threatened birds and the people who care about saving them. How can you tell if there are birds on an island without visiting that island? Conservationists in Hawaii found two high-tech ways to answer that question. First, they are using special equipment called acoustic recording units, which record sounds remotely. Second, the conservationists are using drones that have cameras. These cameras don't take normal pictures. The cameras scan the ground with sensors that record the temperatures of objects. The cameras produce pictures based on the different temperatures of the objects. This process is called thermal imaging. You might wonder why these scientists are going to so much trouble. They're doing this because they are looking for endangered birds. The birds are the Newell's shearwater and the Hawaiian petrel. They are only found in Hawaii, and there are only a few left. These birds face many threats, including flying into power lines at night. Young shearwaters and petrels heading to the sea for the first time can become confused by bright lights at night and run into buildings and other structures. They are also threatened by non-native predators, including feral cats. Newell's shearwaters are black and white birds that can grow more than 12 inches long. Their wingspan can be up to 3 feet wide. The Hawaiian petrel is dark gray and white and can grow to 16 inches long. They also have a wingspan of 3 feet and are popular seabirds in Hawaii. They make a lot of different sounds. One of their calls sounds like ooh-ah-ooh, and people enjoy hearing it. Seabirds such as the Newell's shearwater and Hawaiian petrel are important to their ecosystems. Their poop contains high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus, which are important nutrients for plants. Conservationists thought Newell's shearwaters and Hawaiian petrels lived mainly on the island of Kauai, and that none of them lived on the island of Oahu. Then a few birds were spotted on Oahu. The conservationists wondered if these birds were looking for mates and mating. They didn't want to disturb the birds, so they placed the acoustic recording units in remote mountain locations where birds had been seen. They recorded the birds' sounds to see if they could hear mating calls. Then scientists started using drones to see if they could find the nesting locations for these rare seabirds on Oahu. Although they are still looking at all the information they have collected, it does look like the seabirds may be nesting on Oahu. That is good news for these threatened birds and the people who care about saving them.
Task 3. Please read the instructions and the task.
The new movie Black and Blue is an action thriller about a woman who tries to straddle a divide between two groups of people, African Americans and the police who are supposed to be protecting them. The New Orleans police officer who tries to bridge these worlds is Alicia West, played by the actress Naomi Harris.
Huh?
Against the wall.
What's the problem?
Against the wall!
In the movie's opening scene, she's going for a run. She's wearing a hoodie. Cops stop her for questioning, and it turns rough. While they're searching her, they find her police badge.
Sorry about that. We're looking for someone that matches your description. You know how it is.
Yeah, I know how it is.
This is a very American story, and the actress who carries the film is British. Our co-host, Ari Shapiro, spoke with her about how she relates to the themes of police violence and mistrust.
I mean, I was definitely very aware that it is a uniquely American story. And so, you know, I had to deep dive and do all of my research and so on so that I honored that experience and could play it as authentically as I possibly could. But sadly, you know, the American experience is not exclusive to America. We have the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK, and we have a breakdown of relations between the police and the black community within the UK as well, and many unexplained deaths of black people, perfectly healthy black men in particular that have been arrested and then ended up dead in police custody. And all the issues that you have in America, I think they're much more extreme here, but we have them in the UK as well, for sure.
Yeah. What kind of research did you do?
I was incredibly lucky because Tyrese, who obviously, you know, co-stars in the movie, is from South Central LA. And he was like, the experience that Alicia had growing up and the kind of community she came from is exactly the community that I came from. And so I'm going to help you, and I'm going to be there for you and explain any sort of cultural differences that you don't get.
Can you remember something specific that your co-star Tyrese Gibson told you about his experience growing up as a black man in LA that was very helpful to you in understanding your character in this movie?
I mean, one of the moments that really stuck out in my mind was when he calls the police for help in the movie.
I called you.
And they come and they actually kind of handcuff him.
Back up.
What?
And harass him.
I'm the one who called
you. Police, turn around, hands on the counter. Spread your legs. Spread your legs.
I'm the one who called you, sir. Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that that is an experience that he's seen happen many times before, and how frustrating, belittling, anger-inducing that is as a black man who's, you know, called for help and then actually ends up being treated as though they are the criminal.
These themes that we're talking about seem like they could fit into a very dour and heavy movie, and this film is anything but.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, Dion says that this movie is candy with medicine in it.
This is the director, Dion Taylor.
That's right, yes.
It's a big step for you, because even though audiences have seen you over the years in Moonlight and the James Bond films where you play Moneypenny, I first noticed your performance in the zombie film 28 Days Later back in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time you've played a leading role.
That's right, yeah.
What did it take to make that leap?
So I always said I didn't want to play a lead because I always, I've always found it quite stressful.
So it was a choice.
Yeah. I always said, you know, I don't want the weight of a whole movie because it's kind of stressful enough coming in and doing your part.
Mm-hmm.
And I just enjoyed this kind of collaborative experience of being a part of this whole process. I didn't want to like have the entire spotlight on me. I mean, it's very typical of my kind of personality because I'm much more of an introvert than an extrovert. Bizarrely enough, given that I'm in
you're
this
on screen
profession.
Seen by millions.
Yeah, exactly.
Except it's funny you say, even without playing a lead, playing any role in a film is stressful. You chose to play a lead in a movie that is so stressful.
Oh my gosh, it's so stressful. It's funny because, you know, you read the script, you think, oh, that's great. Oh my gosh, it's so exciting. It's brilliant. And then it's not until you actually start filming it and you realize, well, what? I've got to be running every single day. I've got to be scared every single day. I've got to be jumping through windows. You know what I mean?
And is that what filming is like? Like every day you're running and jumping through windows?
Every day, running, jumping, terrified. I actually signed a contract which said that they weren't even going to get me to run.
Really?
So, yes. So I did no preparation, physical preparation for the role because I was like, you know, someone else is going to be doing all the hard lifting for me and I'm just going to act it. And then you get there and you are confronted with the amazing Dion Taylor, our director, who just smiles.
The new movie Black and Blue is an action thriller about a woman who tries to straddle a divide between two groups of people, African Americans and the police who are supposed to be protecting them. The New Orleans police officer who tries to bridge these worlds is Alicia West, played by the actress Naomi Harris.
Huh?
Against the wall.
What's the problem?
Against the wall!
In the movie's opening scene, she's going for a run. She's wearing a hoodie. Cops stop her for questioning, and it turns rough. While they're searching her, they find her police badge.
Sorry about that. We're looking for someone that matches your description. You know how it is.
Yeah, I know how it is.
This is a very American story, and the actress who carries the film is British. Our co-host, Ari Shapiro, spoke with her about how she relates to the themes of police violence and mistrust.
I mean, I was definitely very aware that it is a uniquely American story. And so, you know, I had to deep dive and do all of my research and so on so that I honored that experience and could play it as authentically as I possibly could. But sadly, you know, the American experience is not exclusive to America. We have the Black Lives Matter movement in the UK, and we have a breakdown of relations between the police and the black community within the UK as well, and many unexplained deaths of black people, perfectly healthy black men in particular that have been arrested and then ended up dead in police custody. And all the issues that you have in America, I think they're much more extreme here, but we have them in the UK as well, for sure.
Yeah. What kind of research did you do?
I was incredibly lucky because Tyrese, who obviously, you know, co-stars in the movie, is from South Central LA. And he was like, the experience that Alicia had growing up and the kind of community she came from is exactly the community that I came from. And so I'm going to help you, and I'm going to be there for you and explain any sort of cultural differences that you don't get.
Can you remember something specific that your co-star Tyrese Gibson told you about his experience growing up as a black man in LA that was very helpful to you in understanding your character in this movie?
I mean, one of the moments that really stuck out in my mind was when he calls the police for help in the movie.
I called you.
And they come and they actually kind of handcuff him.
Back up.
What?
And harass him.
I'm the one who called you.
Police, turn around, hands on the counter. Spread your legs. Spread your legs.
I'm the one who called you, sir. Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that that is an experience that he's seen happen many times before, and how frustrating, belittling, anger-inducing that is as a black man who's, you know, called for help and then actually ends up being treated as though they are the criminal.
These themes that we're talking about seem like they could fit into a very dour and heavy movie, and this film is anything but.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes, Dion says that this movie is candy with medicine in it.
This is the director, Dion Taylor.
That's right, yes.
It's a big step for you, because even though audiences have seen you over the years in Moonlight and the James Bond films where you play Moneypenny, I first noticed your performance in the zombie film 28 Days Later back in 2002. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time you've played a leading role.
That's right, yeah.
What did it take to make that leap?
So I always said I didn't want to play a lead because I always, I've always found it quite stressful.
So it was a choice.
Yeah. I always said, you know, I don't want the weight of a whole movie because it's kind of stressful enough coming in and doing your part. Mm-hmm. And I just enjoyed this kind of collaborative experience of being a part of this whole process. I didn't want to like have the entire spotlight on me. I mean, it's very typical of my kind of personality because I'm much more of an introvert than an extrovert. Bizarrely enough, given that I'm in
you're
this
on screen
profession.
Seen by millions.
Yeah, exactly.
Except it's funny, you say, even without playing a lead, playing any role in a film is stressful. You chose to play a lead in a movie that is so stressful.
Oh my gosh, it's so stressful. It's funny because, you know, you read the script, you think, oh, that's great. Oh my gosh, it's so exciting. It's brilliant. And then it's not until you actually start filming it and you realize, well, what? I've got to be running every single day. I've got to be scared every single day. I've got to be jumping through windows. You know what I mean?
And is that what filming is like? Like every day you're running and jumping through
every
windows?
Every day, running, jumping, terrified. I actually signed a contract which said that they weren't even going to get me to run.
Really?
So, yes. So I did no preparation, physical preparation for the role because I was like, you know, someone else is going to be doing all the hard lifting for me and I'm just going to act it. And then you get there and you are confronted with the amazing Dion Taylor, our director, who, you know, just smiles.
Fin de la prueba.